Thanks. Good. So the first talk of the week that has been dubbed the QCD week, Abitura. So I didn't know quite, well, I did know who I should aim for. I should aim for the N equals 4 grant who sits over here predominantly today. So that's what I've tried doing. So I've cut out a lot of details. But if you want to hear more details, please ask. And I'll be happy to do so on the Blackboard. And if you think that there's something I missed, then please say so, and I will fill in the details. Okay, so please look away. So I'm going to talk about new challenges to theory in the description of LHC collisions. And of course, the new challenges are that suddenly we'll need to worry about multi-leg, meaning many particle production, but we'll need, oh, I missed that, also loop amplitude in order to get not just stability in terms of renormalization factorization scale, because of course when you have many legs you have many powers of alpha s, so the renormalization factorization scale is much bigger than if you just have Brillouin. So you need something to stabilize that, and that's normally higher orders. But also once you start looking at not just Brillouin but processes that has many or have many particles in them, then you can end up in situations where not only do you need higher orders in order to get a satisfactory description of the total cross section, but also since the final state is very complicated to begin with, you may need higher orders in order to just get a satisfactory description of the final state. And here I don't mean in terms of the constituents of the process, but the hard objects that hit here as jets. And I'll discuss that later, what that exactly means. So I'll begin with an elementary discussion of the elements of a proton collisions. There are different aspects that we call hard, scattering, shower, matching, multiple interactions, underlying event, etc. And I'll discuss how the notion of jets allow us to partly ignore many of those steps and get a relation between the perturbative amplitude that we can calculate rigorously by perturbation theory and measurement, so that we don't need to worry necessarily about a lot of the phenomenological models that are necessary if one needs or wants to have an answer in terms of kaons, pions, etc., and not just the abstract jet. So then I'll discuss a bit about multi-jet predictions, why we must care about higher order corrections, at least in some situations, and then briefly a new approach that I've developed. However, it's not the main aim, it's not necessarily to describe this approach, but to describe why something is necessary, why we need to do something more sometimes than just NLO. And then I'll discuss some predictions and first data, just to say that there was first data discussed here at the meeting. And then I'll illustrate how the information or how some understanding of higher order corrections can help us design better analysis, in the sense that sometimes we may want to measure couplings, for example, of the Higgs boson to gluons. If you see a scalar, you want to know, is this the Higgs boson or not? You can only know that by measuring if the couplings are what they should be in the standard model. And here I don't just mean coupling strength, but there are also CP properties of the couplings that you want to make sure are correct in order for you to declare that you really have seen the standard model Higgs. Now, for measurements like these, you may have to go into special corners of phase space where the perturbative corrections are very large and where you therefore need a good understanding of the perturbative corrections in order to design stable analysis. I'll use this as an example for why we want to care about higher order corrections. So of course, now we have collisions at the LHC, and we really must understand how to describe them. In this case here, it's a simple example. It's a W production, or they don't like to call it a W production, they just say it's a W candidate. At 7 TeV collisions, what you see here is the electron, the yellow one, leaving a track. There's some missing transverse momentum here, and then all the blue bit are soft QCD that in this case we will not worry about. If you look at the energy deposits, then you see there's just an energy deposit for an electron. And then For this talk, we will not discuss any of the soft physics, any of the soft breaking up of protons and whatnot that leaves these tracks everywhere in the detector. So the abstract description of such a process here, for example, if it was W plus one jet, would be, you take, for example, a quark from one proton, a gluon colliding from the other proton, and you create a W, and for example, W plus one jet in this case. That is, you create an exoparton. Now, as indicated here, this is not all that goes on. In fact, if you write general purpose Monte Carlos, then you want to describe the physics, more details of the physics than what this picture allows you to. So you add, for example, okay, the incoming quarks can shower, as it's called, when they emit extra particles. The W, of course, decays, for example, in this case, hadronically, and it's not just the C and the S bar that's created, but they also emit extra particles. And finally, you can worry about the collisions of extra particles from each proton. Now, of course, this creates a royal mess of the nice little platonic picture you have. But the point is that if you're happy to ignore all soft things, then you don't need to care to first approximation. I mean, they're power corrections, but if you look at sufficiently hard scales, you may not need to care. And this is where the notion of a jet comes to the rescue. So the jet really is an algorithm that allows you, if you look at, this is an event display for a set, for example, plus three jets. You may be able to see that there are three colored sprays of particles in the detector here. This is the view of the detector from the end. So you've got the one proton beam coming in, another proton beam coming that direction, collision in the middle, and then three sprays of particle in the transverse direction, and then an electron and a positron. If you look at the detector from the side with the collision here, you've got sprays of particles coming up here. Now, each of these sprays of particles are identified by jet algorithms and, identified by an algorithm that looked at how can we combine these things into close objects, into something that we can then identify with the partons that we can describe the collisions of in our perturbative scattering amplitudes. Okay. So the notion of jets allow us to compare a pure perturbation theory with a few partons to the experimental observation of many color singlet hadrons. Okay. Now, often I'll discuss processes in terms of transverse momentum. Transverse momentum is the momentum transverse to the beam. So if there's a hard collision going on, then you can create a lot of hard transverse momentum. And then to describe the momentum along the beam axis, one often uses the rapidity because it's additive in boosts along the set axis. And you may not, the incoming quark and glue here, of course, may not come with equal and opposite momenta. So the whole system may be boosted. So therefore, it's nice to use an observable, which is just additive under boosts. Okay, so what's the point of the jets? Well, the jets, I've zoomed in on this little picture here. And what you see is that each jet, for example, here is an identified hadronic activity. If you don't worry about the description of these pedestals, but just say there's this much amount of energy deposited inside this ring, then you can use just a platonic calculation. If you want to describe the jet profile, as it's called, then you need a general purpose Monte Carlo. So for the rest, whenever you hear jets, it's just an abstraction from what you measure in the detector to something that you can calculate perturbatively. Okay, so then the perturbative description, once that's what you're worried about, is just one of two incoming protons. You have a probability distribution for extracting a given parton from a proton. That probability distribution, so-called, or almost, is measured by other experiment, and then you can use that for making predictions at the LHC. You understand how to evolve it from one energy to another energy. And then you have the calculation of the scattering amplitude. Okay. And that allows you to make predictions for the cross-section. So why would you want to study multi-jet observables? I mean, why not just study something simple in here? Well, first of all, many processes from beyond the standard model If you create particles, for example, sushi particles, they will often have long decay chains, meaning, you know, they don't just decay from Luino to standard model particle, for example, in one decay. So they will often produce many jets. They obviously, or the production of any new particle will predominantly be colored, because the colored cross, or you know, production of colored particles had higher cross section than at the LHC than production of non-colored particles. So therefore, if you see something new, it's likely to be colored. So therefore, when it decays, it will also decay to colored particles, and therefore you will often see jets, i.e. colored particles, that produce sprays of muted particles in the decay. One such thing is, for example, four jets plus missing PT. So the calculation of the signal here is often easy, because you only have like one process often. But the standard model contribution, for example, to four jets plus missing PT is a lot harder to calculate, because you have many more processes going on. So that's one reason. Another reason is that all LHC processes will involve QCD charged particles, obviously. But sometimes the N plus one jet cross section is as large as the N jet cross section. So if you want stability of your and trustworthiness of your calculation, obviously you would want to take higher order corrections into account. So the multi-jet observable is simply a challenge we cannot ignore. We cannot choose just not to care. One example here is Higgs plus more than two jets. So if, when, etc., a fundamental scalar has been found at the LHC, we want to find out whether this really is the one responsible for the ellipse-weak symmetry breaking. So how do we do that? Well, we have to determine the couplings to the Z or the W, and that can be done two ways. Either you produce the Higgs, and then you look at the decay through Zs and Ws, right? Then you can measure the coupling. Or you can ensure that the Higgs is produced through what is called weak Bertrand fusion. So for example, you have two quarks, one from each proton. They exchange a W and a Z, that couples to a W. If you're sure that's how the Higgs is produced, then it turns out that you can actually study the CP properties of this vertex just by studying the angular correlation of the two jets. So the Higgs can decay completely inclusively. You don't need to look in a specific decay channel or anything. You can simply look from the production, what is the CP properties of this vertex. That's very nice. So if you want to see CP even, CP odd, whatever it is in standard model, you can measure whether that's true. The only problem is that, of course, the Higgs could also be produced and give two jets. If you had, for example, a gluon and a quark exchanging a gluon that through a top triangle coupled to the Higgs. And of course, if you just look for jets and Higgs, then you can't tell whether it's one or the other process. It turns out the interference, even, I mean, when this is a quark line, is very small, even at loop level, but still, you cannot tell event by event one from the other. But it turns out that the radiative corrections are very different in these two cases, basically because here color is exchanged between these two particles, and here no color is exchanged. So the radiation pattern when you calculate higher order corrections are very different, and that can be used to distinguish the two processes. And the point is that the CP properties of this coupling here is the opposite of the CP properties of this coupling here. So if you measure just Higgs plus IJS inclusively and you say, oh, it looks as if there's a mixture, it's not quite as it is as the expectation from the standard model of this vertex, then it could A, B, BSN, or it could B, B, contamination from the sample. So you need to sort of understand how to remove this. So it's important to understand the behavior of the QCD process in order to separate these two channels. Quantum mechanically, there's very, very little interference, so it makes sense to talk about separating the two channels. Okay, that's one thing. Of course, you can also measure, if you treat this as a signal process, you can also measure the coupling of the Higgs through the top triangle to the gluons, okay? And that is another thing, you know, what it should be like in the standard model. So, you know, there are many handles you have for when and if, etc., you see a scalar to determine whether it's the standard model of Higgs. Okay, so then it turns out that it's important to understand the behavior of the QCD process in order to extract the CP properties here. Because I said you can measure the CP properties, and I'll discuss that later exactly how, by measuring the azimuthal correlation of these two jets. Okay, this is at leading order. The problem is that the cuts you need to employ, the region in phase space where you're looking in order to find the CP properties, are such that the radiative corrections are large, so often you end up with three jets. And then how do you study the azimuth correlation between three jets? I mean, that's suddenly not so easy to decide what to do. So there we need some insight into the perturbative structure of the radiative corrections in order to design an observable that, for example, allows you to extract the CP properties here, even if there are 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. jets in the sample. So, for example, I mean, all these cuts and designs, blah, right, they were designed long ago how to do these analysis. The problem is that once you sit down and say, okay, now I use the cuts, I look in the region of phase space where this is an interesting process, and then I look at calculating what happens in this process here. And then I look at what is the tree-level cross-section for Higgs plus dijets in this region of phase space, which basically means some the hard jets of 40 GeV, more than 4.2 units of separation between the jets. They're obviously within the detector, then opposite hemispheres of the detector. Okay. So then with some choice of alpha S, which in this case actually was the Higgs mass, you get, for example, 290 femtobarn, which is a measure of how often the process happens. So you may say, okay, that's my cross-section. I can calculate what it would be in weak burst fusion, and I'm happy. The problem is, if you then calculate what is the Higgs plus 3-jet cross-section for the gluon fusion process, you may expect, okay, that's an alpha S correction, so it's 20%. The point is, when you calculate it, you find out it's almost 100% of the 2-jet cross-section. So obviously that's a bit of a problem because of many things. Because if you take this at face value, 290, say that's my Higgs plus 2-jet cross-section, and then you calculate Higgs plus 3-jet cross-section, and they're both meant to be sort of inclusive, then that means that the exclusive 2-jet rate should be very, very small, right? So that also means that if you design anything that depends, a measurement that depends on the final state, and you see that the final state changes this much from one order to the next, then it's untrustworthy. You know, the, whatever, if you say I want to measure the azimuth correlation between two jets to extract the CP properties, and then you find out, well, there are almost always three jets, then your two jet measurement is worth nothing.
Okay.
So that's also obviously an indicator that we need to go further than just a load in this case, right? However, a full fixed order calculation to next to linear order of Higgs plus 2-jet, I don't know if, Thomas, what do you think? I mean, it will be very, very, very difficult. I mean, it has all the difficulty of just dijets, which, you know, the amplitudes have been known for 10 years, and no dijets, I mean, I know you're working on it, but it's not finished yet. And then here you have an extra mass and an extra leg, and so, you know, I think it's fair to say it's untenable at the moment. And yet it seems that's what needed. You need to start worrying about the 4-jet rate. And you could say, why don't I just calculate everything at 3-level? Well, you need the loops in order to merge the sample into one sample so you can do one combined analysis on it all. So what I've done, you know, my work, is to then say, okay, maybe we can't do this exactly, but maybe we can develop a scheme that allows to do some approximations. That's what the Parton shower does. I do some other approximation that allows to get some estimate of what the corrections are and how to get the virtual corrections as well, so that we can make a combined event sample and perform an analysis. I'll discuss this brief, but again, it's not really the point. It's not really to discuss what I've done, but that is something that needs to be done beyond the next linear order sometimes. Okay, so I'll often discuss things that have more than two jets in the final state. The reason for concentrating on more than two jets is that a small number of jets has been solved satisfactorily, I think. PowHig, now they even do two jets. MZN and low, next linear order for very simple processes. So that's one reason, you know, the simpler cases have already been solved. The other reason for concentrating on processes with more than two hard jets is that there's a new special radiation pattern that arises from current scattering. So if we want to look into higher order corrections beyond just the inclusive K factor, meaning what is the change on the total cross-section, then something new happens when you have 2-to-2 scattering of color particles. But I'll concentrate on the hard perturbative corrections, which is relevant for the description of the final state in terms of jets, and that should have been an exclamation mark. So yeah, the goal, not discuss that too much, but the goal of my work was to build a framework for an all-order approximation, summation, which has both virtual and real emissions, which is exactly in another limit than the usual soft and collinear, which is used in the pattern shower, and hopefully it's better suited for describing the radiation relevant for multi-jet production rather than the profile of each jet. So also, I'll show how to obtain the predictions here, but also how the insight we get from studying approximations to the perturbative series can help us in design an improved analysis for extracting the CP properties of the Higgs-Boson couplings. Yeah, so I've already discussed it a few times. The challenge is that the hard emission is less suppressed at increased collider energies. It's clear that if you have 90 GV E plus and minus colliders, how many 45 GV jets can I produce? Then the answer is 2. If you have more energy, you can produce more jets. So, for example, at the Tevatron, one is often in a situation, if you study hard jets, that there are two things that will suppress extra hard jets, extra emission. One is alpha S. The other thing is if you extract more energy in order to create an extra jet, then the PDS will suppress that, because in order to create two hard jets, you already have such large X that any extra PDS, any extra energy you pull out will be penalized by the steeply falling PDFs. So that's basically the change between the Tevatron and the LHC, that at the LHC you may not be penalized so much for creating an extra jet because that there's more energy coming in protons. So NLO will get one hard emission right, but as I've tried to argue, one emission may not always be sufficient. Often it is, and if you ask about total cross-section, NLO inclusive property is sufficient. But if you ask about what does the final state look like, NLO may not be sufficient. So a pattern shower, which is one sort of approximation of the soft collinear emissions, does many emissions, but not the hard ones, then there are ways to sort of correct that, which is called pattern shower plus matching, and that's worked very well at the Tevatron, but question is whether it's sufficient at the LHC. A solution, blah, blah, and status. I'll show some data that can tell us about our perturbative tools already. You know, are they good, are they not? Okay, so the challenge here. I was talking about the rapidity before. So this is a plot of the extra number of jets beyond 2. If you study W plus 2 jet production at the LHC, this was at 14 TV LHC. The blue line here is the extra number of jets that you get in your event as a function of the rapidity span between the forward and the backward hard jet. So you see a very clear rise. This is 20 GV jets, and you also see that very quickly you get 1, is what you can get with NLO, so already at 2 units of rapidity, you sort of, on average, have already used up your NLO calculation. Okay, so this is a very basic observation that when you increase the rapidity span between the forward and backward hard jet, then you get more and more radiation. That's the basic motivation for BF-Kelvin summations, and indeed these predictions obtained within some BF-Kelvin approximation. I'll explain what that is later, but I just want to say that this tendency of increasing counts on real radiation depending on the rapidity span between the forward and backward jet, or the rapidity length of the event, it's not something that arises just in BF-Kelvin summation. And graciously, the Black Hat collaboration had tried to look into this as well. They did it slightly differently. Instead of studying the average number of jets, they studied the 3-jet rate over the 2-jet rate as a function of the pseudo-rapidity between the forward and backward hard jet. Now, actually, if you have a sample of just 2-jet and 3-jet states, then the average number of jets is obviously, for example, the 2-jet, 2 times the 2-jet exclusive, plus 3 times the 3-jet exclusive, and then divided by the 2-jet inclusive cross-section, right? But that's equal to, you take a 2 out, and then 2 plus, and then the 3-jet over the 2J width. So when you see this, then you add 2 to it and you get this plot here. Except that this plot here started, you should add 2 here. So it should have started 2 here. This is the number of extra jets. And this is, so actually it's similar here. It's the same plot. Okay, it's the same plot. Same number, as long as your sample only contains 2 and 3 jet events. So what you see here, as soon as you go out to about 3 units of rapidity, your 3 jet is the same as your 2 jet, right? Sorry, your 3 jet is 50% of your 2 jet sample. So again, the 3 jet exclusive has the same weight as the 2 jet exclusive, right? And if you, 3 units of rapidity is not particularly large. So, you know, there's also signed within the fixed order calculation that perhaps the exclusive final state is not described so stable. Even though perhaps your cross-section, inclusive cross-section, can be stable, if you look into how is the final state distributed on a different jet count, then NLO may not be sufficient for stability. So it's also interesting to see that the large contribution from the real radiative corrections to W plus digests is actually not revealed by the inclusive K factor. That's less than 1. So if you say, what is the inclusive K factor? It's 0.9. Okay? That 0.9 does not reveal that 50% of the real emission, of 50% of the cross-section, is actually W plus 3 jet, right? That's not revealed by the inclusive K factor. You have to look into the final state to see that. Okay, so all calculation methods and processes will agree that they, you know, if you have 2 jets and you pull them apart in rapidity, if you have the forward and the backward jet and you pull them apart in rapidity, then there's more phase space for emitting in between the 2 jets. Anyone will agree on that. But the mechanism for this emission will differ between processes. So for example, I was talking about the weak boson fusion into Higgs and the gluon fusion into Higgs. They will have very different properties for emitting into this rapidity span. But also the calculational methods will have different mechanism for emitting into the span. It's clear that an NLO calculation can emit 1 jet and 1 jet only. A shower can emit more, but it may not get the hard emission rights. So that's the thing. But the nice thing is that we can now test against data. Whatever method you have for a description, you can test it against data. So this high energy jets that I've been working on, the goal is inspired by the great Fedin and Lipatov. Okay. So we want a sufficiently simple model for hard radiative corrections that we can construct an all-order sum and evaluate it explicitly so that we can get a description of the final state. Now it's very easy to get a very simple model, right? That you can sum to all orders. The difficulty is to get a model that is also accurate, that so that it's worth, you know, listening to what the final result is. And that is the difficulty, is to get something which is both A, simple, and B, accurate, so that the description is relevant. So it's not always easy. We had, I was at CERN before, and there was a very wise man at a seminar who said that we use known results to gain deeper insights. At that point, I was a young postdoc. I upgraded, and I said, well, maybe we should use some insight to get yet unknown results. But that is, of course, a little bit difficult. But that's what I'll try to do. Okay. So in order to do that, we have to discuss a bit about factorization of QCD matrix. So it's well known that QCD matrix elements factorize in certain kinematic limits. One very well known one is the soft limit that will lead to iconal approximation that will enter many resummation formulae, right? But like all good limits, the iconal approximation is applied outside its strict region of validity, in the sense that, you know, it's valid when it's soft. But in the soft limit, there's no observable consequence of the emission. Yeah, okay. So you have something which is exact in a certain limit, but in that limit it's actually irrelevant discussing the emission. So I'll discuss a less well-studied factorization of scattering amplitudes in a different kinematic limit, which should be better suited for describing perturbative correction of half partial emission, but unfortunately this factorization only becomes exact in a region which is outside the reach of any collider. Okay. So that's the difficulty. We know what the factorization is out there, but we have to construct something which works down here. So this factorization actually goes back a long, 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 long way. And that's why I said maybe we should use some insight to get some yet unknown results. So it's based basically on redshift factorization. So in the high energy limit, 2 to 2 scattering amplitudes are dominated by the T10 exchange of the particle of the highest spin. So that means that we know a form of the 2 to 2 scattering in the redshift limit, which means large S fixed T of Mandelson. So there, these amplitudes should grow S to some power, depending on the theory, and then some impact factors that depend just on the scattering momenta. Okay, so the question is, can we find a multiparticle generalization of this? You know, so that we can study not just 2 to 2, but 2 to 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 15, 30. So that's what I'll be working on. Okay, so this is an old diagram from 1974, just to show that that's when I was born. Okay, good. Actually, people have been working on this for a long time. And as I said, Fadin and Lipatov are the great inspiration. And they, long time ago, demonstrated that it in this limit where you have, for example, a 2 to 6 scattering amplitude, in the limit where the transverse momentum of each of these gluons are of the same order, no hierarchy, and the invariant mass between each one of them is large, then we actually know the result of all 2 to n scattering amplitudes. You could get, I know the result of all 2 to n scattering amplitudes for gluons at tree level. That's not what they say. They say we know all the order results for the 2 to n scattering amplitudes, you know, virtual corrections included. Okay? And it can be, you know, it breaks up into, effective vertices and effective propagators. So that you can write the 2 to n scattering amplitudes as what they call an impact factor, which describes the coupling of two on-shell gluons with an off-shell T-channel exchange. Then a T-channel momentum, something that describes the effective propagator, which is just an exponential of resummation here. And then a vertex that describes the emission of a gluon from two such off-shell gluons here. And so forth, you have n of these vertices down to the last impact factor that describes again the coupling of two on-shell gluons with an off-shell T-channel exchange. So this formula works when the invariant mass of each gluon is between each pair of gluons is very large. Okay, and then that allows you, as I say, to get an expression for the scattering matrix element, and I've just taken here the tree level expressions. So there's a universal behavior of scattering amplitudes in the high energy limit, also sometimes called the multi-regi kinematic limit, where the rapidities are strongly ordered, you know, the big separation of rapidity, and all the transverse momenta are similar. So when I say universal behavior, I mean if you study gluon-gluon, many gluons, quark blue to quark, many gluons, or two different quarks with many gluons emitted, then the only difference, you have some S squared, some color averaging, this is the impact factor, 1 over P perp, 1 over the transverse momentum. Then you have 1 over the transverse momentum of each emitted gluon, and 1 over the transverse momentum of the last gluon. So, you know, for every gluon you have 1 over the transverse momentum squared. Okay. If you have a quark, then the only thing you do is to replace a CA with a CF, color factors. Okay. So you notice here that there's no rapidity dependence, and that's of course because you've taken the limit where the rapidity separation is large between infinite between every single particle. So there's no rapidity dependence left. This of course also means that it's very easy to formulate a differential equation in rapidity of these quantities, and that's the BFKL equation. Okay, that allows you to resum these contributions.
Excuse me. Yeah. Now, in these expressions, I mean, a few slides ago, you argued that that the behavior only depends on the spin of the exchange particles, and now I see that the quark and gluon multi-regi amplitudes are actually identical. So where did spin factor go?
Of the exchange particle, they always exchange a gluon, whether it's a gluon up here or a quark up there.
So the quark basically runs through as a spectator, is the outermost particle also in the final state?
Yeah, so at leading logarithmic power, there's or a linear logarithmic accuracy, there's never a quark propagator in the T-channel. In fact, if you work it out, you'll see that it is explicitly suppressed in the... so if you just have a 2 to 3 scattering, for example, and you order them quark, glue, quark, glue, glue, or you could order them, you can't see it this way, or you could order them quark, glue, where there's ordering in rapidity, and then gluon, quark, gluon, you'll find that this scattering amplitude is suppressed by an order of the invariant mass of these two particles compared to this. So if you're interested in the dominant contribution to 3-jet production for a given rapidity configuration, then this dominates over this, systematically by an invariant mass.
Does this also hold true for gauge boson plus multi-jet production?
So there you get into a discussion of how close does the gauge boson have to be to the quark leg that is emitted from it. And if you look at the rapidity distribution there, then it's very wide. It's a Gaussian with a width of, half width of about 2 units. So that doesn't constrain the quark line so much. You know, you want the gate boson to be somewhere in the middle of the detector to be observed, the decay process to be observed. But that actually doesn't constrain the quark line so much in rapidity. Okay, so the only difference is color factors. Of course, Thomas, this is something you just check numerically. You just compare what is the okay. So anyway, the question is, okay, very nice approximation, but is it relevant? So we can check here. If we take a 3-jet scattering, 2 to 3 scattering, and we say we want to study 40 GeV jets in a Mercedes star configuration, and then we want to place them at rapidities minus delta y, 0 and delta y, and then we want to study what is the approximation here and compare that to the true scattering cross section. So as I said, there's no rapidity dependence in the Beefkill result, it's just a fixed value. Then you can say, okay, what's the true number? That's this blue line here, the amplitude of scattering matrix element squared of quark glue to quark glue gluon, okay? So you see, yes, we have the right limit. We also see the right limit is obtained at plus minus 7 units of rapidity, so that's well outside the detector in the LAC. So, unless that's the setup you're interested in describing, forget about Beefkill.
Is this a comparison to given order of PWM expansion, or it's your sum?
It's the alpha S cube term. So it's terminating the Beefkill resummation and just checking order by order how well does it reproduce the perturbative, the full perturbative series.
When you're talking about Beefkill resummation, which coupling constant you put there? What's argument that's the coupling constant?
Well, that doesn't matter. You should use this what I'm checking here is just the kinematic behavior. You can choose whatever you want for your G squared here.
So you fixed the order of coupling constant?
I just use the same coupling constant in Beefkill and in a fixed order calculation just to check how well is the kinematic structure of the Beefkill approximation, how well is that approximating my full scattering matrix element? Okay, so not very well. Okay. However, so one prediction from Beefkill was that there was this universality. If you exchange a quark line with a gluon, then you should get something similar except for color factors. Sorry, bam, I used the green line. Shoot me. Okay. What you see is that you get the up to color factors, you get the same limit, but also you see that they're actually quite similar, down to some fairly low rapidities up to color factors. And if you do study pure gluon scattering, you see the same. Yeah, the limit is correct. When you rescale with color factors, they're sort of universal down to some limit. So what we'll do is to devise a formalism that instead of using this dashed approximation up here, for example, for the 2 to 3 scattering, gets the blue dashed line here. Okay. And so a simple approximation that is as accurate as that, and that still allows us to go to all orders. So as I say, the inspiration is from Fadim and Lipatov. They tell us worry just about the T-channel gluon exchanges. By that I don't mean just take those diagrams, because that's a gauge-dependent statement, right? We don't want to do that. But we want to describe the T-channel pole of your scattering matrix element, full gauge-invariant scattering matrix element. Find the T-channel pole and describe that. That's what we're after. Okay. The difference here comes from kinematic approximations. I just want to say we can do better if we are happy enough that we at some point have to put it on a computer and not get analytic answers. Then we can get the dashed line instead of the dashed line up here. Okay. So how do you describe a T-channel exchange? Well, we all know how to do that with quarks, right? When two quarks scatter, it's only through T-channel exchange. And how do you describe the T-channel exchange? You describe that as two currents contracted over a T-channel pole. That is, by definition, a T-channel exchange, right? So this scattering amplitude is completely T-channel factorized, right? It's two currents contracted over a T-channel pole. Okay, so the question is, can we do this for gluons as well? And the happy answer is yes. So, but let me first explain then what building blocks we get for making amplitudes, right? So if we just study first quark scattering with X-ray emissions, then we have the two quark lines. We have some effective T-channel propagator here, which is the normal propagator, and then the particles have to be some extra virtual corrections. This vertex here, instead of just doing 1 over k perp squared, we just use a full current. And the emission here for extra gluons, which we describe here as an effective vertex, is really the sum of icon emissions of the extremal legs, and then the leading contribution from the three gluon vertex. That you can actually combine into a gauge invariant sum. Okay, so we can do PG.V and get zero, so it's gauge invariant, and we can get an approximation to the 2 to 3 scattering matrix elements. Okay, so what happens when we do quark gluon scattering? You know, then suddenly you don't just have one diagram, and it looks like if you have a S, a T, and a U channel pole, what happens, blah, 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 surely this breaks down. Well, actually, if you do a direct calculation of the quark glue scattering, and I here denominated the helicities, then you find that you can still describe the full sum, I mean exact full sum of these three scattering amplitudes as a current from the quark line, a normal quark current, even though, you know, now okay, there are two vertices, but a normal quark current, and then a normal quark current for the gluon as well. It's just that the color factor in front is a little bit special and depends on the acceleration on the light cone of this gluon. So basically, the more it accelerates, the stronger color factor it has. The bigger is this color factor once you square it. So that's quite a nice intuitive result. The bigger the acceleration, the more the radiation. We know that. The nice thing is that it's still just a current contraction and just a T-channel pole. Okay, so the picture we have for quark scattering holds also in quark gluon scattering.
Where did that thing in the bracket come from?
That's just the, okay, so what we do is we choose a specific representation of the spinners, but of course it works in any representation. And then this is, I mean, these are just the color factors, and this then comes out from the gauge vectors that you choose. But of course, when you do the sum, it doesn't matter. You know, ultimately, it doesn't matter on what you choose. But we just actually the choices we made for gauge and representation of the spinners in for this calculation put this T-channel diagram here to zero. You know, so in that calculation, actually, this T-channel diagram is zero. But the T-channel pole is built up by the S and the U. But of course, this is a gauge-independent statement and completely independent on what you choose. The nice thing here is that as long as you keep it as currents, that allow you to clearly identify what goes on at the top and what goes on at the bottom. But if you use identities to rewrite this, right, as a, you know, 2A, 1B, right, then suddenly you lose that separation of what goes on at the quark line and what goes on at the gluon line.
So if you had quark gluons, there would just be two copies of this?
Not exact, but it actually holds also for, so of course the question is, if you do gluon scattering, how do you define STU channel? So that you can do if you have gluons of different helicities, then you can clearly define what is S and U and T-channel. And there again you find an exact complete T-channel factorization, that there are no S and U-channel poles once you do the full gauge independent sum. The color factor, and it still just becomes a contraction of currents, the color factor is slightly different, but it's, you know, quite good approximation. It's there are no other poles, there's just the T-channel pole. Okay. Yeah. So.
Back to the slide. So, I mean, given this, the last diagram is quark exchange. So.
Well, that's one way of drawing it. You could also draw it, you know, with these two.
Yeah.
Sure.
No, I'm just looking at the last one.
Yeah.
It is quark exchange. So.
Yeah.
So in it's power suppressed with respect to the one that you exchange. By a factor of root T or S. How does it contribute to the full result?
So I think that statement depends on what. So when you add in the
U channel suppressed, it's one over S.
Yes, but
it's U channel. It's what goes into
exactly.
So.
Yeah. Sure, but still, when you sum it all up, then you get this gauge independent contributions, and of course there's interference between all of them. But when you sum it all up, you actually end up with this contribution.
Cannot be. I mean, the central diagram goes like 1 over T, and that is correct. I mean, that's what the
diagram
says. But the one with focus change is root T or S suppressed with respect to the central diagram that goes back
on.
And the one on the left, which is S channel exchange, is actually T or S suppressed.
I'll be happy to discuss this later, but I mean, I just want to say there's no doubt on this, because if you take this and all the other helicity configurations, square them, then you actually get the full result. I mean, there's, I mean, we check this carefully. There's, I mean, there's not. We can even check, you know, in MatGraph, we can check each helicity configuration by its own.
No, I'm sure that the formula is correct. I'm just saying that I'm not sure that those, the first and the third diagrams contribute to it.
Well, that's a gauge-dependent statement. You know, which diagram contributes is a gauge-dependent statement.
What Vittorio is saying, that they're just looking for the leading behavior, energy behavior. Once you have leading energy behavior, should the gauge invariant itself.
Sure, the leading...
So you know that the first and third diagram is suppressed by powers of S, and the middle one is dominant one. It should be gauge invariant.
No. You can always choose a gauge where this is zero.
Yeah.
You can always choose a gauge where that's zero.
This gauge, like Excel gauge. But then,
sorry?
Your
pixel
gauge.
No. It's not. It's just a gauge for your external gauge. Right? You just when you do spinner formalism, you just choose a gauge. You can always choose a gauge where this is zero. Yeah.
Okay, but so the statement that the leading behavior in the high energy limit is S.
Yes.
It's not a gauge invariant.
Yes, it is.
It's gauge.
Of course, it's gauge. Yeah.
So saying that the leading behavior is given by the higher spin exchange is independent of the choice of the gauge.
So the highest spin exchange. So the statement is that, for example, the scattering amplitude is proportional to S to some power, and then some. Gamma of T.
And this doesn't depend on the gauge.
No, this doesn't depend on the gauge. But the type of particle exchange will determine this number. So when you sum the full gauge invariant thing up, then you may not be from the T-channel diagram, because you can always choose a gauge where that's zero. But of course, that then shifts this contribution onto the other diagrams, right? But this omega here, or the power of S in the scattering cross section, is determined by what type of particle you can exchange.
Yeah.
So if a gluon exchange is possible
yeah.
in describing these two, then you get a specific power in S of the order of your. Okay. So your question about what to do with W's. Well, of course, W's can be emitted only from quark lines. So in this framework, if we want to do W plus jets, we just have to calculate the emission of a W from a quark line that can happen before or after the T-channel exchange. So we have an effective vertex and then otherwise the same contribution. Okay. So I didn't want this to be too yeah. Anyway. So what I would just want to say is that we have a prescription for the 2 to n matrix element, including virtual corrections, which I didn't discuss at all, but they are included with the Lyapunov ansatz that just change the propagator. And that actually means that we have a very easy organization of the cancellation of infrared divergences. So because we only have a subset of the processes going on, our cancellation of infrared divergences is very much simpler than in a full next field model calculation. And that is what allows us to just simply naively construct and numerically evaluate the old order sum, you know, simply, you know, what is the 3 result, 4 result, 5, etc., with a phase-based slice, gluon contribution. We simplify the cross-section and allows us to go to all orders. Okay, and then, of course, we can match, but that's, I don't want to discuss this. I just want to show some predictions. So if you look at this is just inclusive diet, and you look at the rapidity difference between the forward and the backward jet, and the average number of jet, you see that it very quickly, or it quickly rises, even up beyond 3 when you study 30 GV jets. Okay. So of course, an NLO calculation, if it gives you 3 jets on average, that means that there are no 2 jet events in your 2 jet inclusive calculation. So it's not just when you study large rapidities that this is interesting. For example, if you study HT, which is the scalar sum of transverse energy, which is a poor man's approach to estimating the total energy of the event. Remember, we don't know always how much transverse energy is in an event if there's a neutrino or something escaping. But HT is sort of a lower estimate of the total energy. And if you study large HT, I mean, when you study new heavy particles, well, heavy means large HT, right? Because if it was light, it would have been discovered. So when you study large HT, you see that actually the same thing happens. You get an increase in the average number of jets when you go to large HT, even just in Dijkit. So that means in the region where you might be particularly interested in your perturbative calculation, well, I would guess that the fixed order NLO calculation is not so stable in HT. So just some data. I just want to show that all this talk about data is yellow, our prediction is blue. I just want to show that all this talk about, you know, the average number of jets increasing when you increase delta Y actually is happening. It's worth worrying about. The numbers aren't small either, right? So one is here. So when you have one extra jet in the event, then the NLO calculation is certainly has used up its ability to do anything useful. I would like to discuss this further, but I'm not going to do this here, because this analysis is slightly flawed in the sense that it wants to see exclusively what is the dependence on delta Y, but the cuts they use, unfortunately, introduce always a large PT ratio that helps the shower or needs the shower to get a correct description. Okay, so why are digits so interesting? Well, it has many similarities to Higgs plus digits. So if you study here in Higgs plus digits, the average number of jets as a function of the rapidity span between the forward and the backward jet in gluon fusion, Higgs plus digits, then the green area here is the estimate you get from an NLO calculation. The red you get from a shower matched to Higgs plus 4 jets. And the blue you get from our description. So you see, for small rapidities, which is all the Tevatron ever tested, we all sort of agree. But when you go to larger rapidity, which is the interest at the LHC for this process is from 4 and beyond, then there's a big difference, okay? So that's obviously something that we need to check. This is 40 GV jets, by the way. It's not too soft. Okay, so I just want to quickly say something about the...
Wait, what were the color bands? The bands are the variation. Sorry, I just missed that.
Yeah, so the bands are the variation of the renormalization scale, renormalization factorization scale. unfortunately, it's not done the same way in all approaches. It's done the same way in the green and the blue approach, but in the shower, you don't have the freedom to play with the factorization scale in the same way. So what Stefan did there was to vary the scale in the splitting function by a factor of 2. Right.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's not a fair comparison of the factorization scheme for the green one. However, for the blue and the green, it's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same.
That seems too small for the red one.
For the red, yes. But that's because it's not the same variation as in the green and the blue. It is, however, still an indication of how much you can tweak your answer by varying the renormalization factorization scheme. All this plot is meant to show is that if this doesn't agree with data, you can't make it green by just tweaking the renormalization factorization scheme. Yeah, it is truly different behavior. Of course, it's well understood, right? So this is an NLO calculation. It has 2 jet, it has 3 jet. If you get 2.5, then your 3 and 4 jet sample is equally big. And obviously, you don't emit much. I mean, come on, what do you expect? So you cannot expect it to rise much beyond that. Okay. So all this discussion about the azimuth angle, I don't know how much time I'll have to do that, but I'll do it very quickly. Okay, so the point is this. The considerations are valid both for weak boson fusion and gluon fusion. And the point is, if you study this process here, then of course the amplitude can be calculated as a contraction of a current from the quark line, and an effective vertex, and then divided by 2 T-channel propagators. And this vertex here has a CP even and a CP odd component here. Now, that depends on whether it's gluon fusion or weak boson fusion, which one you choose, or which one is the standard model contribution. Now, if we take this term here, it's easy to see for this term here how the 2 jet azimuthal correlation will depend. If we take this term here and we put ourselves in a situation where the set component of these jets here are much, much bigger than the transverse component, and we say small energy loss so that the incoming and outgoing energy of these quarks are similar, then of course this epsilon contraction here will tend to favor the energy and the set component of the jet compared to the transverse component, and you'll end up with mu nu having to be 0.1, and then you're left with the transverse component for these T-channel propagators here. Okay. So that means that this whole matrix element here becomes proportional to the cross product between the T-channel momenta exchanged. So of course that cross product has either a sine squared or a cos squared behavior, depending on whether it's the epsilon or the other term that you get here. Okay. So that means that just by studying the azimuthal correlation between these 2 jets, you can infer what vertex, what CP structure this vertex has. That's very nice. And that's actually what it looks like when you do gluon fusion. You plot what is the cross-section differential on the azimuthal angle between the 2 jets, and you get this nice cosine behavior. Okay. And that tells you that you have a CP even Higgs coupling. That's very nice. Okay, the problem is, what cuts do I need in order to see this? And
do you do that with an effective vertex from the Higgs
group? Yeah, it's the effective vertex. It's a large top mass limit. But as you've shown, it also works when you do the full. Okay, so what is the point? The point here is that in order to display this nice cosine behavior, you have to separate the jets from the Higgs boson. Basically, that ensures that your T-channel dominated and not dominated by diagrams where you have a 3 gluon and a Higgs effective vertex. So what I've got here is the cross-section. It's obviously dominated when there's no rapidity separation, but the signal in black here, black means a big cosine modulation. That is dominated when you have a large rapidity separation between your 2 jets. So if you say, I want to have a jet, some separation, and some Higgs, so some jet separation, Higgs separation jet, then that's a straight line on this line here. And you can say, okay, I want the signal down here and the cross-section then down here. So that separation is the separation between a jet, a Higgs, and a jet. Sorry, I'm doing this a bit quickly. I just want to say you have to require some repetitive separation in order to be able to extract the cosine modulation. But the problem with inducing a large repetitive separation is obviously then you start getting into the region where you get extra jets. So what do? If you have three jets, which jets do you do? Which jets do you use in order to do the azimuthal correlation? If you do the two hardest ones, well, that may not be good. And in any case, there's a significant washing out. Another thing you could do is to say, I don't want to look at three jet events. I want to only have two jet events. You know, so if there are three jets, I just reject it. But if we look at the exclusive jet count, then if you reject anything that has three or more jets, then you lose half your cross-section. You know, you can do that. But you know, it will take you just longer to get the measurement. So what I'm going to suggest instead is to say, well, we actually do understand some analytic structure of the scattering amplitude. If we can get some inspiration from the high energy limit, then if we have a 2 to 5 gluon and Higgs scattering amplitude, then again, that will factorize into, you know, normal gluon emissions, and then this effective vertex, whether it's in the last top mass limit or not, etc., etc. So what we'll see is that this effective vertex depends on the local, if you so say, T-channel momentum, QA and QB, which you found by rapidity ordering your particles, and then simply just subtracting your way down in the T-channel momentum here. Okay? So that means that the high energy limit tells us to investigate, if we have more than two jets, the azimuthal angle between the sum of jet vectors on one side in rapidity and the sum of jet vectors on the other side for rapidity. That will give us QA and QB. Okay, that's the high energy limit. That's the one we know only works at, you know, 14 units of rapidity separation. That's when the exact result works. However, when you study it with a full matrix element, you still find that it works. You know, here we've taken three jets. Here we've taken in black is a two-jet result, the nice cosine modulation. These are three-jet results in varying event selections of increasing difficulty of describing it in the high energy limit. But what you see is, as long as you sum the jet vectors and look at the azimuthal correlation between the sums, you get the same nice cosine behavior, and you're able to extract that, okay, you have a CP odd Higgs or something like this. Okay. I just want to say it works much better than if you look at just the hardest jets. If you look at the azimuthal correlation between the hardest jets, you get this blue histogram, which has nothing to do with a cosine. Okay, that's all I want to say. I've demonstrated that the high energy limit can also tell you how to do an analysis of three jet events that otherwise was too hidden in the complicated structure of the analytic full one loop amplitude to dig out. Good. So, summary. So, despite the enormous success of the unitarity approach, right, there might still be some work left for some of us. In the perturbative description of LHC scatterings. I mean, it really has been fantastic to see the progress, but I still hope that I'll have a job in a few years. So, high energy jet, I discussed that this is not. I just want to say that the insight, not only have we developed a perturbative tool, but we've also helped in designing some new searches or methods for extracting CP properties. And the data already collected is shedding light on the multi-jet environment in the new high energy domain. Thank you.
Very good. Something that was pretty obvious in this talk is notice the overlap with N equals 4 super Yang Mills, the Reggie limit.
I forgot to say that actually there's a lot.
Oh, right there. Yeah. Use the Reggie limit query also, right? To do the remainder function at N equals 4 super Yang Mills. And I'm sure there's actually much more overlap. So you guys should really take advantage of, N equals 4 people should really take advantage of having the experts and Toria also on the Reggie limit. But anyway, are there questions? Any more comments? Anyway, thanks a lot for that really beautiful talk.